It's time for All Things Northwest with Northwest Missouri State University President Dr. John Jasinski. Each month, Dr. Jasinski will visit with community and educational leaders about exciting developments and collaborations happening throughout our region. Underwriting for All Things Northwest comes from Nottoway County Economic Development and Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. More at facebook.com/NWMORCOG. And now, the 10th president of Northwest Missouri State University, Dr. John Jasinski.
Welcome to this month's edition of All Things Northwest, a show devoted to all the good about the people, places, events, and stories of our region. We here at Northwest Missouri State University and your public radio partners, KXCV, KRNW, trust you had a great April, and like you, are enjoying a long-awaited spring. I am very pleased to welcome you to the May 2014 edition of our show. This month, we will be focusing on rural health care. Our guests today are John Doolittle, President and CEO of Northwest Medical Center in Albany, Missouri, Chris Stipe, CEO of Clarinda Regional Health Center in Clarinda, Myra Evans, CEO of Community Hospital in Fairfax, Missouri, and Gray Cox, President and CEO of St. Francis Hospital and Health Services. Thanks for joining the All Things Northwest team, and we hope you enjoy this month's edition. And welcome to the program, Chris, John, Myra, and Gray. Let's get started, ladies and gentlemen, and talk about healthcare. And, you know, we read about it in the press, we hear about it on the radio, TV, throughout social media. Why has it become all of a sudden this huge, prominent issue in our country and certainly well beyond?
I was looking at statistics, and it looks like healthcare is 18% of GDP now, which it just continues to mushroom. And I think healthcare is expensive, and the inputs that it takes to deliver healthcare are expensive. And I think that's really the concern. Also, we need to improve quality, and we've been doing that. And you know, I'm really proud of our hospital and healthcare in general for attacking some of the safety and quality issues that we have in the system. But I think the cost is what's making it an issue, and the cost of premiums is what most people are focused on.
I'd like just to add that I think the cost is high, but our customers, the patients, have such high expectations. They expect the quality, the safety that Chris has alluded to, but they don't expect to pay the prices that we have to charge to be able to afford to do that for them.
As the oldest person probably sitting in this room, I reflect back when I was in school back in the early 70s, and the question then was what would happen when the percentage of the gross national product hit 8%? That was back in the early 70s, and people wrung their hands and wondered what was going to happen. And it is 18% now, and that takes from education, that takes away from obviously other things that this society needs to do.
And I think there's the crowding out here in this country, but there's also what I think is the largest issue here, which is this is a competitiveness issue on a global scale. Healthcare in this country on a per capita or per person basis is 2 to 2.5 times higher than it is in other industrialized countries. And we have placed most of the burden for healthcare expense either on employers who are being forced to compete globally or on our federal government, which has a tremendous debt. Or you could say also state governments, and in Missouri, that's a state that has a balanced budget amendment and has to operate with real fiscal constraints that has a very noticeable crowding out effect on higher education and others. So we've got a great big problem, and it does seem like healthcare in this country is out of line from a cost perspective. And there are a lot of good people in this room, a lot of good people everywhere that are working on bringing that cost in line and also at the same time improving quality of care.
All Things Northwest listeners, you heard in order Chris, Myra, Gray, and John. And so as we go throughout this program, I'll try to make sure our listeners know who's talking and representing your healthcare system. But bottom line, you guys are talking about certainly cost, patient expectations, rising patient expectations, that competitiveness issue. And there's no doubt that, you know, on the healthcare front, this issue is not going to go away. We've got some issues in front of us. I'm so proud of leaders like you and for those that you represent, that you're tackling it head on. Let's talk about
rural health care. How is that different from, say, suburban health care? You know, what are the key issues in rural health care? And when people step up and say health care in general, is that any different than, say, rural health care? So let's just focus first on what's so different about rural health care.
I'll start. I think everywhere, access to care is such an incredibly important issue. And, you know, in a rural area, there is a cost to providing that high quality of care that folks expect and deserve. It's a little easier to produce that at an efficient cost level when you're dealing with a larger population. And so as rural health care providers, our job is to bring access to expertise and care in an area where, from a business standpoint, we don't necessarily have the scope or the volume to pay for the new diagnostic equipment or the expensive human resources. And so we figure out new and better ways to bring that expertise to folks where they live.
And John Doolittle, you talk about that expertise and bringing that health care, but nonetheless, doesn't matter where you're at, you're still expected to provide that level of significant outcomes, essentially. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah, the protocols that doctors use are going to be exactly the same. I've asked our medical staff many times as we compare ourselves with some of our colleagues in St. Louis, is there really a difference the way that you treat diabetes in the city versus in a rural area? And the answer is always no. It's exactly the same. Now, what you don't have in a rural area sometimes is the specialty care that supports some of the primary care needs of people. And therefore, there's some advantage that people see in finding a place that care is provided in a transparent way. And we need to work hard to show folks that you can start at our place. And we have excellent primary care, and we will support you all the way to your final needs.
And, Gray, I should mention, too, to our listeners that I personally serve on the board of St. Francis Hospital and Health Services. I want to make sure listeners know that. But interesting how you compare what doctors do, say, here in Maryville and then in St. Louis, and the question, you know, do we treat diabetes any differently? No, not at all. Myra?
Yeah, and I'll just echo what these other two men have said. Access is very important. Our community needs the access to the care. And like Gray alluded to, you know, we can't provide all the care that our patients sometimes need, but we can be that first point of contact for them. Our primary care providers know lots of specialists they can refer them on to and then expect to return those patients to our hospital for the care that we can provide, which is very important for our success. And then the resources that we need to have available. John spoke about some of the equipment, some of the technology, and also the human resources. You know, it's hard sometimes to maintain those professionals in our rural area without partnerships with larger facilities and such as a university, you know, developing some programs that would feed us professional folks that could be employed in our local communities.
Okay, Chris?
Yeah, physicians in particular, you know, trying to recruit physicians to rural areas and being able to make that affordable as well as retain those providers, you know, that's probably human resources is 60%, 50, 60, 70% of our cost in our organizations. And so the expertise that is required to deliver healthcare, we need those medical decision makers. And that's one of the things that I think is driving cost of care in rural areas in particular, not just in the cities, is labor, the cost of labor and the shortage of nurses, the shortage of physicians.
I know John wants to jump in real quick. So what I'm hearing, though, certainly from the human resource component, that drives cost because there's some expertise obviously involved, as well as all the support functions. But also, you guys are talking about the costs of technology, and if you talk about some kind of machine, that examination machine that we're bringing into a hospital, you know, those things cost a lot, and not all the time can we afford that. So, John, what else?
Yeah, the good news here, and we've talked about the challenges, and they're real, but the good news is all of our organizations do function very effectively as this front end. And what's funny to me is that many urban and suburban healthcare organizations are actually, as they deal with this cost issue moving forward, trying to become more like us. They are shifting a focus to primary care. They're shifting a focus to social workers, to using connective tissue that exists in communities to take really good care of folks in a holistic way. So we send people off sometimes to access specialized technology or specialty physicians and then doing a very effective job of connecting it all together around the person. Organizations in urban suburban areas sometimes really struggle to do that. They're trying to figure out how to be more like us. And then the sort of proof in the pudding there is that if you look at Medicare data, Medicare beneficiaries who live in rural areas cost the government less than their suburban and urban counterparts. So we're actually doing a good job, maybe, of taking care of people holistically.
Very interesting. I mean, you kind of opened my eyes there just for a little bit. You just provided some data that perhaps not everybody understands or even is aware of relative to the costs of those that you provide service to here in the rural areas. Gray?
If I could jump in and kind of echo what John's just been saying, too, is people should understand that our physicians could be physicians in a major metropolitan area. They didn't choose rural health care because it was easier or because it was something lesser. They chose it because of lifestyle issues or just a desire to serve a smaller community. The staff that we have could work at any major hospital anywhere. The equipment that we do use is usually the same equipment that's being used other places. So really the confidence people can have in their medical staff providers, I think, is exceptional in our area.
Yeah, and just to add a little bit, you know, I think John was talking about, the rural health care and the cost. And we have always tried to keep our costs within line. As a critical access hospital, we do get reimbursed on reasonable costs. And what's reasonable is different for a lot of people. But we've always been very conservative. We don't have, several layers of staff. You know, we have a lot of frontline workers that are also managers. And I think a lot of the larger facilities now with the new healthcare reform are really trying to look for ways to cut costs where we've already kept our costs down and really cut that excess out through the years.
I'd like to talk a little bit about kind of the health condition of the communities in which you serve. We'll move on to Affordable Health Care Act. I'm sure we've got a few minutes we can talk about that and Medicaid expansion, perhaps some other topics. But let's talk about that growing area, maybe an industry term, maybe not our listeners don't know about this, but population health and the whole focus on maybe a different way of looking at the health care continuum. Listeners, you are listening to All Things Northwest on KXCV KRNW. I'm your host, John Jasinski. I'm here today with Chris Stipe, Myra Evans, Gray Cox, and John Doolittle. Population health. Population health is a semi-new term for some people, perhaps not for you guys. Talk about that and what it means to your institutions.
You know, health reform is about moving from a system where we treat folks who are sick to more of a focus on prevention and wellness, personal responsibility, chronic disease management, and there is certainly a lot of savings there. If our talented doctors in the rural areas, which we've all spoke about, and we're very proud of our medical staffs and what they bring to the table, but you know, if we can change how we approach healthcare and get that focus into prevention and wellness and personal responsibility, folks are going to have to take more responsibility for their own healthcare and their own health status. There's huge savings in the system. My concern is that as we transition to that system and hospitals starting to act like insurance companies and taking on risk and things, that transition is going to be difficult. And, because the system is built around a fee-for-service or a get sick, we treat you, we make you better, and transitioning to, one of the things we're doing in Clarinda is using health coaches to reach out to patients and manage diabetes and manage hypertension better so that people don't end up in the emergency room and don't end up admitted in the hospital. But, moving from the old system to the new is going to be a difficult transition, and I'm afraid that, there could be hospitals close in that transition if you move too fast or if you move too slow or if you take on risk and you act like an insurance company. And, we're not insurance companies. We're not experts at managing risk. And that concerns me as hospitals move into different arrangements, accountable care organizations, those types of things. I don't want to blow everybody's mind with terms and that type of stuff, but that concerns me greatly.
Well, Chris, and you're talking about really the structure of what you do, and I'm thinking about someone like myself from a a typical view of a hospital. I get sick, I go to see my doctors and so on. I wait until that. And you're saying, hey, Jasinski, get it together. You got to be prevention-based. Grab a health coach. Can I get a health coach, by the way? Is it?
Our health coach would be happy to talk to you about managing any conditions you might have.
Oh, I got plenty, as our listeners know.
So. He's a chronic runner. Let's see if we can do something about
he's
that.
He's a runner. Yeah.
But bottom line is we're not just talking about your systems. We're talking about the population, the patients that have to change their ways. And that's, I assume, for you guys, well, that's a changing kind of mindset. Is that true?
Yeah, I will say it is. And, you know, we did our community health needs assessment and, of course, identified as well probably as the others around the table that we don't have a very fit society in our neighborhood, I guess. Wellness is a big concern of ours, and so we are looking for ways to partner and actually have had a couple businesses come to us in anticipation they need to have their workforce be more well, and how can we help them? You know, how can we partner with them to keep their health care costs down because they know their premiums are raising? So we also have gone into the local schools and partnered with the school nurses and developed a Check It at the Door program, which we'll check blood pressure, cholesterol, and glucose on teenagers and then educate them and their parents on an ongoing basis throughout the school year to try and live more healthy and then measure again at the end of the school year. This is our second year doing that. So I think, you know, talking to people, having people reach out to us and how can we partner with them to help them become more healthy is going to be important. Society as a whole doesn't want to be told how to live, but I think through employers, through insurance programs, you know, if we can be a part of that, provide that education, provide some of that testing and the knowledge that we already possess in conjunction with the medical staffs, we can, you know, make a difference in the community.
Right. Population health can be looked at in lots of different ways. You can take individual disease entities such as diabetes. Certainly, if we're concerned about the cost of health care in the United States, approaching a way to teach our youth to eat right, exercise right, which will have a big effect on the number of diabetics that we have in year 2050. I was at a program a while back that estimated it was possible that 50% of the kids that are in fifth and sixth grade today by 2050 could have diabetes if we don't change our eating habits, our lifestyle, and that type of thing. It's a preventable disease in some cases. So you need to get, you can look at it from a disease standpoint, and it certainly involves our education system. It involves a lot more than just a doctor's office or a hospital or even a healthcare system. It's a community-wide effort.
Sure. John?
There are 8,760 hours in a 365-day year. Most of the people listening to this program will spend a single-digit number or maybe 0 hours in a doctor's office or a hospital this year.
They'll spend a lot of those hours listening to KXCBK. I definitely want to point that out.
If they know what's good for them, they will, yes.
Only this show.
And yeah, the same loop over and over. The brilliance, I'm sure, is just mind-boggling to everyone. But the point I'm trying to make is fairly obvious. There's only so much you can do to influence those behavior choices in a traditional healthcare setting. And really, it is about lifestyle change, and I think it's about incentives. People are going to have to self-regulate and self-govern in the other 8,758 hours that they're not in a doctor's office. And we're pretty good at that. We're pretty good at doing contests. We're pretty good at knowing what to do. We're pretty good at using peer pressure in good ways to help people make good choices. What's funny is none of us in the sort of traditional healthcare space have to do that to survive yet. We are still kind of operating in this sick care, health care environment. I think we're all very excited about being part of the transition to a true health and wellness focus. And I think you're starting to see now that the people who pay for care in this country are encouraging us in that direction and maybe allowing us not to put ourselves out of business by keeping people healthy. We all do flu shots. We advertise them like crazy. And the reality is we probably cost ourselves money when we do it, if we help prevent disease. But we want to do that. We all view that as part of our mission. We want to be part of healthy, thriving communities. It is, I think, about changing the incentives a little bit. As Chris said, the people who have financial risk for care don't want care, the way we deliver it, to be delivered. We need to share in the benefit and share in the incentives to help people in our communities live healthy and well.
When we come back, we will talk about what you can do to stay healthy and also the Affordable Care Act along with Medicaid expansion. This is All Things Northwest on KXEV KRNW.
Northwest Missouri State University focuses on student success. Every student, every day. Management Information Systems major Wyatt Price says he chose Northwest because of helpful professors.
Faculty in my department, one in particular, Dr. Carol Spradling, has helped me from the time that I got here. She was my freshman seminar instructor to right up to getting a job that I have, you know, after graduation.
Price is from Ridgeway, Missouri, and will begin working for Cerner in Kansas City May 29th.
Support for All Things Northwest is provided in part by the Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments, which offers programming, products, and services to its member governments in Atchison, Holt, Gentry, Nottoway, and Worth counties. More at nwmorcog.org.
Northwest Missouri State University strives to provide a great learning environment for students. Alumnus Jay Liebenguth says one thing he remembers about Northwest is building great relationships.
Not only are there a lot of great people around there that are students, there's also a lot of great faculty. And I just remember fondly of being able to sit around and chat with others about ideas and throw, you know, questions at each other. And it really continued the learning outside the classroom.
Liebenguth currently works as an entrepreneur in Kansas City.
Underwriting support for All Things Northwest is provided by Nottoway County Economic Development, promoting the community, supporting business development, and growing opportunity for Northwest Missouri. The NCED Business Support Team is at your service. More at nottoway.biz.
You're listening to All Things Northwest on KXEV KRNW. I'm your host, John Jasinski, here today with Chris Stipe, John Doolittle, Myra Evans, and Gray Cox. They lead your healthcare provider institutions here in Northwest Missouri and Southern Iowa. From our listeners' point of view as a patient, what advice would you guys give to the patients out there? I say the patients, and I don't mean that from a traditional sense now. I'm thinking about just from a preventative point of view, what can we do to help the cause in this infancy transition? I mean, hey, look, it's 2014, 2015. You guys are saying that in the next 1, 3, 5, 10 years, this model may look a lot different for me, for my children. What can I do with my family to begin that role going down the hill?
Well, for starters, one of the things that we are in infancy on, but I think it's growing quickly, is we all are working towards electronic medical records. And people can begin to become more involved in their own health care right on down to the level of their own record. And following the, you can pull up in our institution, you can pull up my chart, and you can see your own record, and you can become involved yourself. You don't need to wait 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month to see your doctor next. You can see what your lab report was. And I think people need to take a personal accountability towards their own health in that way. And some of the data that's available now through the electronic medical records is fantastic.
I'll just add, I think the patients need to know about preventative health care, do those preventative checks, you know, know your cholesterol number, know your glucose number, know what your blood pressure is, because all of those things are treatable, some are preventable, and if you're aware of what your body's telling you, that's important. You know, we all know we need to exercise. We all know we need to eat healthier, you know, fruits and vegetables, but I think just knowing those numbers and knowing that you can react to those numbers with your physician's advice and how to be more healthier.
Okay, thank you. John, Chris?
Echo those, certainly. And I think, you know, those who aren't sure yet, you know, there's a sledgehammer coming here. The sledgehammer is, for the last 40 or 50 years in this country, actually more than that, basically since the end of World War II, moving into the creation of Medicare in the 60s, people haven't had to share a lot in the cost of their own health care. And yet over the last few years, we're seeing, you know, plans that used to have $100 or $200 annual deductibles now have a $2,000 or a $5,000 annual deductible. Those plans usually pay 100% for the sort of preventive care that we're all trying to incentivize. And so my easy answer here is figure out what sort of preventive care is covered in your plan and take advantage of it. So many people who have access to a free annual physical, to well woman checks, to, you know, cancer screenings of all types. I don't think, you know, even though most men 50 and older probably should have a screening colonoscopy, they aren't lined up outside our hospital right now waiting for one. Understandably so, but the benefit of that test has been well shown, and people do need to take control of this issue and keep their own health at a high level and their costs at a low level. The incentives are there. I would encourage folks to really activate around getting that preventive care.
There's already employers who are charging different premiums for smokers. You know, our hospital, our employees, if they don't participate in our wellness program, we still make it a choice. But if they don't participate in our wellness program and get a health coach and do the things that we ask them to do, then they pay a higher premium. And I think it's upwards of 8 or 9% at this point. So there's a lot of employers. I mean, Mercy Medical Center, we have a relationship with them. We're affiliated with them in Des Moines. They will not even hire smokers. And you can do that. I mean, it's not discrimination. It's you can put that on your applications. And so folks are starting to already see the sledgehammer that John's talking about, and it's many times through their employers. But I think the states, the Iowa Medicaid expansion, you know, they're asking folks, you will have to pay premiums if you do not get a wellness check and do, you know, do the prevention and do the things that you need to do. They're going to be asking folks to pay those premiums. The trouble is, these are folks who don't have a lot of means to pay premiums as it is, and how are you going to collect it, and through the tax system and through and that type of thing. So it gets complicated.
So from our listeners' point of view, I get it. I really do. I hope our listeners do too. You know, taking control of your own destiny, having accountability with your own health, being preventative with regard to wellness checks and all of those, having a financial incentive because that cost shifting is going on, and it's a sledgehammer, as John, you kind of mentioned. It's coming at us, and it's not a if, it's probably a when, and the when is probably soon. And so it's in all of our best interest for a better lifestyle, to be around our kids and grandkids and loved ones longer, obviously, but also in a more healthy fashion, but also from a financial point of view in the pocketbook. So the personal side is pretty darn clear. I need to make sure I go on record here and say, you know what, I was supposed to have that after 50 colonoscopy last year.
Do you want to schedule one?
Was going to schedule it. No, got too busy. Didn't do it. And actually, I just talked about see, I'm avoiding the answer, Chris. But bottom line is, for me, I knew that was important. I didn't get it done in the last quarter of last year. That's one of my goals here right now is, come on, man, get it done. So that's really what you guys are talking about, is me taking control, our listeners taking control of their own destiny. Right.
An example would be mammography. I mean, our county, Nottoway County, is pretty good at that. 67% of our ladies get the test as they should, but that means 33% don't.
Right.
So there's a big margin of error there.
And it's funny, Gray, you mentioned that, because Nottoway County was just rated the number one healthiest county in the state of Missouri. Yet as we look at the statistics, we were 10th or 12th or 15th in these various categories. And you do pull back and say, well, that's great, 67%, but boy, 33% could really do something. So the personal side is really at stake. Let's kind of transition into that structural side. You four, as administrators, CEOs of your organizations, Chris, you've already mentioned a few of the issues here, but if you talk about affordable health care, Medicaid expansion, the move, even though it's in infancy, towards population health, the structural side of health care organizations is going through that huge transition and a sledgehammer. So kind of talk about that. What is this? You know, from a listener point of view, we hear Affordable Health Care Act, ACOs, Obamacare, whatever term you use, someone put it out there in a sentence or two. What exactly are we talking about, and what is impacting you and certainly the patients?
Structurally, all of these reforms are about a search for value, and value is higher quality, lower cost. That takes a whole bunch of different forms. One of the ones that I think is very interesting is comparative effectiveness research. Okay, so there's a group called PCORI. You can go out and look it up if you want to. But it's a new organization that is designed to evaluate all of these new interventions in care and trying to guide people. Is this something I should buy or not? You know, so we in this country have access to amazing technology, probably the best in the world. And even though we don't always rate as the strongest country in the world in healthcare quality, people travel from all over the world to come to the United States to access our specialists, to access our amazing institutions and technology. But sometimes people want something just because it's new. And the search for value here is to use all of the data that's gathered in those electronic health records that Gray was talking about to do testing and to understand how do we guide people to be more informed as consumers. Which technologies, which providers, what are the evidence-based things that I should go do, and then provide incentives for that. And so that's not the part of Obamacare that's, you know, interesting in a sort of healthcare.gov way, but it is the stuff that's happening kind of behind the scenes. There's an organization called RAND. It's a think tank. They usually work on Department of Defense stuff, but RAND Health is a huge, huge organization. And RAND looked at tens of thousands of medical records. And what they figured out, and this was when it was all paper-based and this was a lot harder to do, what they figured out is that the right care was delivered in this country about half the time. So the other half of the time, you either got too much care or too little care. Now, it's hard to know exactly what to do, but half the time doesn't sound that great. That was 15 years ago, and we're all getting a lot better. But the point is, this search for value in care is, I think, the defining characteristic of all of this. And that's what we're all seeking to do, is improve the value that we are delivering.
And there's no doubt that, as we said previously, the issue is cost in many respects. There's the 18% of our gross national products. So as this act was passed, the American Hospital Association, in essence, promised in excess of $150 billion over a 6 to 8 year period of time from hospitals. So cuts were put in place at that point in time, and it was always intended at that point in time that more people would become covered through the expansion of Medicaid. And as such, two things were taking place simultaneously. One, costs were going down, but more people were being covered. So it was both, if you want to look at it that way, a cost and almost an ethical solution. In our state, of course, that breaks down to about $4 billion to the hospitals in the state of Missouri. And in our hospital alone in the next 6 years at St. Francis, it's about $7.5 million worth of reductions that are in the Affordable Care Act. That money was intended to be at least partially covered by expansion of more people covered through Medicaid expansion, and that has not occurred yet as a result of the Supreme Court decision, which actually allowed the act to be constitutional, but optional at the state level. So it's a practical issue at the cost level for each of our institutions, for sure.
Yes.
Chris, Myra, anything else on the kind of the opening construct of Affordable Care Act before we talk about its impacts?
Well, it brings up Gray reference cost. You know, what concerns me most about what the discussions are in Washington and always have been, and, you know, it's a political discussion, not a pragmatic one. And, you know, Gray alluded to costs. Well, costs go down. What we're paying for healthcare went down. Costs continue to go up. And that is really one of my, you know, frustrations with the whole discussion and the whole, you know, Affordable Care Act and the reform discussion, is that Washington and the American public need to understand that the cost of care is going up, the cost of labor, the cost of pharmaceuticals, the cost of facilities, the cost of supplies and technology. That continues to go up. What people are willing to pay for health care is going down, and it makes for a difficult situation where everybody doesn't want to pay for something, and the costs continue to go up. Someone has to pay for that, and you know, it's through the Affordable Care Act we're trying to get people access to affordable insurance, okay? That's what it's doing through mandates, government mandates, employer mandates, government subsidies, Medicaid expansion. But the Affordable Care Act does not make the delivery of care less expensive, and those costs continue to go up. So as we open up the system and we bring more people in to be insured, my concern is that folks, you know, are reluctant to pay for the real cost of care that are coming in through all these inputs that I mentioned, especially labor continues to go up, the cost of labor and healthcare. So there's a crossroads there, and the Affordable Care Act, in some ways, in no way does it do anything about the input cost into healthcare. It only looks at getting people on insurance and affordably on insurance, and many times with government subsidies. So I just want people to understand that.
But I think you have to kind of look at it with all these things coming together. You know, John mentioned the value of healthcare. You know, Chris talked about the cost. And then we talked earlier about expectations of our patients. And I think we have to help our patients and the communities we serve understand that we're not talking about rationing healthcare, but we have to look at the things that give you value. That's why we've all started doing, you know, core measures, working on some of the quality projects. Some of my doctors, you know, call it cookbook medicine, but there are protocols that have been found to be the best way to care for patients. Gray alluded to, you know, you treat diabetes the same you do in the rural communities you do in the city. But there are certain things that some doctors might do that are very expensive, adding to the total cost. The insurers don't want to pay for it. You got to get it pre-certified before they will. And we have to pull all these things together, making sure we're providing the care that is needed, not excess care like John alluded to, because the costs keep going up. You know, my employees want a raise just like a manufacturer's employees want a raise every year. You know, we have to look at how can we help make healthcare more efficient with these expectations being high. You know, there are end-of-life decisions that need to be talked about. You know, having the biggest, the best MRI or CAT scan isn't necessarily the best care for the patient, but the patient may demand that, but it's a higher cost. But what value is received from that?
Okay. Public radio listeners, you're listening to All Things Northwest on KXEV KRNW. I'm your host, John Jasinski, here today with Chris Stipe, John Doolittle, Myra Evans, and Gray Cox. They lead your healthcare provider institutions here in Northwest Missouri and certainly in Southern Iowa. Ladies and gentlemen, it's intriguing as I'm listening to you talk about healthcare issues, about the Affordable Health Care Act. Our industries are pretty similar. And so if you talk about higher education, education in general, and I think in some ways a lot of the business sector, you know, in our, I think we have a lot of the same issues is what I would say. In our circles, we had an iron triangle called access, affordability, and quality, making education, higher education, accessible because it is a moral imperative. It really is, making sure that higher ed is accessible to all, whether it be through certificates, associate's degrees, bachelor's, master's, and so on. It's a moral imperative. So you got the access part of the triangle. You have the affordability triangle. I don't have to tell our listeners about, you know, all the ranting and ravings about the costs of education and, you know, they've skyrocketed and so on. And so we have our own ways of really trying to hit those costs, but yet at the same time maintain, if not enhance, our already strong quality, and making sure that we have evidence-based, in your guys' case, evidence-based medicine, evidence-based educational practices to deliver that quality. So I'm listening to this, and I can almost insert education, K-12, higher ed, into the equation and probably some business entities. But if the core construct is you've got some political issues going on, you've got probably some myths and some mistruths from those that you provide service to, whether it be the patients or those that you partner with. So talk about that Affordable Health Care Act with regard to the actual impacts on what you're seeing and the way you're running your organizations and potentially into the future.
John, the triangle that you describe, healthcare has its version. And one of the wonderful things that has happened, it's really been led in this country, one of the wonderful things that happened in the last 20 years is that the quality movement has hit healthcare. And we now understand that higher quality is actually lower cost in healthcare. So the triangle that seemed to be sort of the points were at odds with each other. Boy, if you raise the quality, it's going to cost more. Going back to that RAND study that I mentioned and several others, what we've understood in healthcare is it's been very much consumer-driven, but the consumers didn't have to pay for any of it, right? It was paid for by the government. It was paid for by the employer. And we've had overconsumption. And in some cases, we've had half the time we didn't quite get it right. So now you're seeing an industry that had operated a little bit like a cottage industry being forced to have some of the same discipline from a quality standpoint that manufacturers have, that other industries have. And so you have with this quality wave that the triangle in healthcare maybe wasn't quite as intractable as it was in other places. And there really is opportunity. And that's tough because now we're rewiring, as Myra said, consumer expectations, professional expectations of some of our physicians. And in some ways, we're trying to lower our own revenues by helping people. As I said before, flu shots are an easy example, but there are several others. As a global competitiveness issue, right, the dispassionate hand of global economics is going to force us to spend less on healthcare in this country. It's a national defense issue. It's a world competitiveness issue. And so we are all trying to figure out how to work through our organizations to actually bring higher quality at lower cost. And what the research shows from the last 20 years is there's actually opportunity. And we've made a tremendous amount of progress already. There's a study that just came out last week in partnership with the March of Dimes. Hospitals in the state of Missouri have almost eliminated basically early C-sections, early elective births for Medicaid beneficiaries. And that's because it's better for moms, it's better for babies, it costs a whole lot less. And there are many other examples of places where the industry has taken on this quality problem.
I think one of the things that you see nationally without a doubt is you've seen a shift from inpatient care to outpatient care. You see a decline in use of the inpatient bed, which is the most expensive thing that you can do. You see a tremendous shift from inpatient surgery to outpatient surgery. It's astonishing when you've reached the age that I have at the number of days or even hours that you stay in the hospital anymore for certain surgeries that used to be quite a period of time. I'm old enough that my wife stayed in the hospital 5 days for each of our three children. and that day passed, I don't know how far back that passed. But what you see is an effort to provide the care at the most efficient and effective level. So not inpatient, but outpatient. Not emergency room, but physician office. Perhaps in some cases, even the use of walk-in clinics at a even less expense, if that's possible. So you're seeing a shift, and I think many people in healthcare can see where to go, but the payment mechanism isn't exactly there. So you know a little bit of where this puck is going. You just don't know how you're going to get paid for it when you get there.
You bet. And, Gray, I have to just tell on myself just a little bit. Denise and I, my wife and I, may have broke that five-day cycle a little bit with our first child years and years ago. Her water broke at 9 o'clock at night, and we're like, you know, let's wait till after midnight, make sure we got one less day on the bill here, and then get her out in time, you know. But that wasn't me driven. It was a co-decision. I just want to go on record. We're getting ready to close our program, All Things Northwest. I just want to ask you about Medicaid expansion briefly. We've kind of hit upon it in some way, shape, or form. But, boy, the issues out there, tough issue. I know Iowa certainly has passed it. Missouri has not. But what is the Medicaid gap, and what's this all about from a listener point of view?
Well, I think Gray alluded to it earlier about not having the Medicaid expansion, and that's what we were counting on for some of these cuts. The sequestration of 2% that we all took, we thought we'd make some of it up by having some of those patients insured through Medicaid. A lot of our ER traffic is Medicaid, our Medicaid patients, and we know it's been proven that if people have insurance, they're more likely to have a primary care provider and go there for that care. But they know if they don't have insurance, they can come to the ER. We have to take care of them when they come to the ER. So it's a costlier place to have your primary care provided. And if we could get some expansion through Medicaid in Missouri, that could certainly help that situation.
I think one of the most striking things to me when I look at the statistics is the fact that 3 out of 4 uninsured Missourians are employed. So what we really have in Missouri is folks that work, but they make too much money to qualify for the current Medicaid eligibility, and therefore they kind of fall into a, some of them fall into a, what's called the Medicaid gap, a group of people that was supposed to be picked up by the passage and expansion of Medicaid. So these are folks that are friends and neighbors. They're the people that you see in store. There's quite a sizable number of them. They're not unemployed. They're working in many cases, and they just either they do not have insurance because their employer doesn't provide it, or they may be farmers, or they just are with small employers. So there's quite a group of people there, and we're not serving those folks well because they don't use the system in the most efficient way.
Yeah, Dr. J, Missourians are paying taxes to fund the federal share of Medicaid across this country. So money is leaving this state every year. By failing to act on Medicaid expansion, we are making sure that Missourians' dollars are used for employers, care providers, and people in other states. We're leaving $2 billion a year on the table right now in federal funds that are ready to come into this state to provide approximately 25,000 jobs. Why we're doing that remains unclear to me. I understand it's a political issue. I understand people are concerned that if we expand Medicaid eligibility in Missouri, that if the federal funds run out at some point, it leaves us on the hook in a balanced budget state. As someone who serves on the Missouri Hospital Association board, I can tell you hospitals are ready to talk about that eventuality and make a pledge to make this thing doable if that's what it takes. But it is fairly amazing right now that we're leaving the money and opportunity on the table in this state, and we're putting a lot of hospitals, a lot of doctors' viability at risk. And you know, along with that is another fairness issue, and Gray hit this. The Affordable Care Act provides subsidies for people who make from 100% up through 400% of the federal poverty level. They're required to get insurance now, and it provides them money to help do that. So a person who makes 101% of the federal poverty level gets a lot of assistance in paying their health premiums. In the state of Missouri, a person who makes less than that, let's say 99% of the federal poverty level, gets no assistance whatsoever and is still required by law to buy that health insurance. If they don't, they pay a penalty on their taxes next year. And by definition, this is not somebody who has a lot of extra room next year when they pay their taxes. The design of this program was that states would expand Medicaid eligibility so that person at 99% is not completely stuck without health insurance. And the reality is that person waits and gets care in that expensive setting that Myra talked about, the emergency department, at the last minute. Or even worse, they don't get care. And then we're talking about life and death. And why we're leaving $2 billion on the table and putting 200,000 Missourians in a position to be in that coverage gap really is unacceptable to me.
I think I'm glad I left that to the end of the program because I've stirred up some passions here. We can begin to close there. But what I would say is this. Obviously, that Medicaid gap is critical. Take politics out of it. We're talking about service to patients. We're talking about jobs, if you want to look at it from an economic development point of view. We're talking about the viability of our communities. And Myra, as you talked about, it ties back into population health, and as Gray and Chris, John, you've talked about prevention-based and evidence-based and taking control of our own destinies. It all ties together. It does make sense. It's clear to me that we need to have you guys back here in several months and really talk about advancements in rural health care and go beyond, because there's so much at stake, and what a critical, critical issue. This is the way I'd like to end our program. We've hit some pretty heavy topics here, but yet in our industries, there's so many good things that happen day to day, and it's why we all come to work, because our service is so, so very important. Talk about the goodness of you guys and your teammates, obviously, on a daily basis, serving those that you serve. What's your takeaway as CEOs of your organizations, and why do you do what you do, and what's the goodness in your roles?
It's what we live for. You know, it's what our employees live for, is being there for our communities. And, you know, it's not like in the city, folks aren't there for in the hospitals to care for folks, but there's just a connection in a rural community with your patient base, and it's like family. And that's why we come to work every day, and we want to make sure that the changes and the reform result in better care in our facilities, and that our facilities are able to not just survive but thrive as we move forward. So.
Thank you, Chris. John?
About 4 years ago, I got to come home to start working in the hospital where I was born. And over the last 4 years, I have seen passionate caregivers at Northwest Medical Center save people's lives, create incredible happiness and hope for people who come to us for help, and treat each other really well. The jobs we provide, the quality of life we enable are fantastic contributions to this region. And my job is to be a steward and help provide those opportunities for folks and let our miracle workers keep working miracles. And it is very easy for me to be excited about that task.
That's great. Thank you. Myra.
Yeah, I'm just very proud of the quality care that we do provide in the rural area. You know, all of our facilities are great hospitals. Our patients do connect with us. It's very often when I make patient rounds that I'll have a patient say, you know, I had to go elsewhere to have some kind of surgery or something, but I'm so glad I can come home because everybody takes such good care of me here. You know, patients don't always know quality, but they know when they're getting good care, and there is maybe a difference there, but still, we have to keep our quality high because it's looked at, it's measured, but I'm just really proud of our staff and our hospital and the care we provide in the community.
Well, many years ago, at the birth of my son, his life, I realized that God is in control, of course, but from a human standpoint, there was an individual that really saved his life there in the first 15 minutes to hour. And I went back to visit her a couple years later, and because of her taking care of so many patients, she really didn't remember that day. And I thought to myself many times, that day affected the rest of my life. I can't tell you how it changed my life. And yet, it was just a day to her. And I'm so proud of our caregivers. Every day they give service that will affect people's lives for decades. Husbands, wives, children. And they do it with great passion and they try to stay away from the furor of how the finances all work and all that kind of stuff. It's really, they didn't go into it for that, and that's really what motivates me.
Well, thank you. We thank our guests, Chris Stipe, John Doolittle, Myra Evans, and Gray Cox. Thank you all for being with us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks, too, to our producer, Ben Nelly, a student here at Northwest Missouri State University, along with KXEV station manager, Rodney Harris. Friends, take good care. Treat each other well. Provide good works for others, and keep celebrating and advancing our region. I'm John Jasinski, and thanks for your support of All Things Northwest, KXCV, KRNW, and Public Radio.
Support for All Things Northwest comes from Nottoway County Economic Development and Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. More on Facebook at facebook.com/NWMORCOG. Theme music for the program was composed by Northwest professor Dr. William Richardson. The music was recorded by vocal music education major Jordan Andrews, piano, music major Daniel Bates, bass, audio and production major Mark Ludwig, drums, and Dr. William Richardson, trumpet. The program is written and produced by multimedia journalism major Ben Noley. Join us again next month for All Things Northwest.